All right, we'll begin with the questions, if there are any, about your practice. Yes, Mobius. Thank you.
First off, I'd like to ask, was it you that left me the page on karma and the little coin? Or was that somebody else entirely?
That was somebody else entirely.
Who left that? I would like to thank that person very much. Well, whoever it was, thank you very, very much. That was deeply appreciated.
Wonderful. Well, speaking of things left, Eve, did you ever find your yoga mat?
It wasn't mine.
Oh.
Yeah, it showed up.
It just materialized the next day. Oh, that's wonderful. Okay. All right.
Then going on to a meditation question. I have been, the term is, I believe, the nimitta, correct? The light that is mind-generated sensation, or...
That's not actually the correct term, but it's the term that everybody uses nowadays.
Okay, well, the commonly used term, I have been, when it first was appearing, for those who are unfamiliar with the term nimitta, it is a... or at least for me, it takes the appearance of a mind-generated light. Started off as flickering lights and colors that I could perceive, and I tried not to pay too much attention to it. It would pass and it would come and it would go. But now I'm noticing that I can actually place attention upon it, and it doesn't immediately vanish.
Oh, very good.
And also there's a sound that goes with it as well, a sort of. Mm-hmm. A chiming, ringing, mind-generated noise for sure. I thought it was a ceiling fan for a while. But I've noticed that now that I can place attention upon it, and it might be there for a while, and then sometimes it disappears, and then other times it grows a little bit, and then it disappears. The question is, one, how can I use that to deepen the meditation, and two, What is the best usage in the meditation? What would be the best usage of that for deepening insight?
Well, the use for it in meditation would be to allow that illumination phenomenon to grow very, very strong, and use it as the meditation object for entering the luminous jhanas. Now, that doing that and practicing that will strengthen your samatha. To make it into an insight practice, what you need to do is you need to, when you come out of the jhana, you need to compare the state of your mind in access to the state of your mind in the jhana, and to the state of your mind when you come out of the jhana. When you come out of the jhana, you don't come back to the state you were in access, and these three are different. When you come out of the jhana, the imprint of the jhana will be very, very clear, and you compare it to the state your mind is in at that point. So this assumes that you've had a fair bit of experience with sustained metacognitive introspective awareness. And certainly, if you have that, then you're going to observe the differences of the mind in jhana and the mind that's just come out of jhana. And then the access state you should be able to recall as well. Especially, the thing is, to practice the jhanas properly, you should practice entering, staying for a set amount of time, and leaving the jhana, and do that over and over and over again. And that's actually more important than staying in a jhana for a long time. If you have done that, then you will have a great familiarity with the state of the mind and access concentration. So now you can compare all three mental states with each other. And in that way, you'll discover some of the subtleties of your own mind. Then when you move to second, third, and fourth jhanas, and you repeat that the same way, you see, going through the jhanas, first, second, third, fourth, and then on through the four formless jhanas, it's like peeling away layers, you know. Each jhana, you go to the next jhana, and it's like you've peeled away another layer. And if you are doing systematically comparing the mind in jhana and the mind not in jhana, then powerful insight will arise. So that's how you use that. Other than that, the illumination phenomena is just one of those fun, interesting things that tells you that your practice is succeeding and you're making good progress.
Can the illumination phenomenon, would you recommend using the illumination phenomenon as a meditation object, even if the immediate intent is not to enter jhana, just as to explore it and see what that is like? Would that aid the practice as well?
I think you might find it interesting and entertaining, and there's nothing wrong with it. But I would suggest that, except for, you know, exploring it a little bit and then leaving it, unless you plan to enter the jhanas, that you just let it be, because it is one aspect of the development of full, complete pacification of the senses, and the rising of meditative joy. So once you've satisfied your curiosity, leave it alone and let the process continue. Does anyone else smell smell of something burning? I don't think it's coming from in here.
Yeah, a little bit.
Yeah, it's definitely the smell of smoke. Thank you. Thank you, thank you. It'd be a shame to burn up. Yes, you want to pass the microphone over to Terry?
Okay, this is funny. It's actually perfect timing since Nancy's not here, because it sort of involves her. It's not really about her. It's about my perceptions. I was in the kitchen working, and a thought came up, oh, Nancy's mad at me, I'm not doing this thing right. You know, those kind of thoughts that happen. And then I thought, another part of me was like, okay, you know, that just happens, it's not true, we know that. And then after that, I returned to my practice, which was kind of just asking, what is this? What is this? That was asking, what is this about everything I was doing? And then all of a sudden, it wasn't like I was thinking about Nancy at all. It wasn't like I was not ignoring her. Or it was like, it wasn't Nancy. It was a different kind of experience, and I don't know how to describe it besides that. So I'm curious.
Well, I don't feel like I have enough information to make a comment, really. Other than, it's really nice that you were able to move outside of the usual kind of things. Somebody's mad at us, or we think we've offended somebody.
Yeah.
It was really nice that you were able to just look at that and let go of it. And
I'm kind of wondering if it's related to another little experience I had, which was also kind of momentary. While I was hiking, I was walking up a trail and practicing mindfulness, and everything you can have that state where everything is really real and really clear, more than it is in usual life. And then I was going uphill, and I had to kind of balance between stones, and all of a sudden it was just pure experience. There were no stones, no balancing, no nothing, just the pure experience. And I think that was kind of similar. Those two experiences were similar.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Those.
And I'm guessing what happened with Nancy is just that the usual thoughts someone has about what is a person, they just all kind of stopped. Mm-hmm. That's what I think happened, but I was just curious what you thought about it.
Yes. Well, these are actually what I would call these is insight experiences, that where you, I mean, what you've described is a definite change in perception.
Mm-hmm.
And like I said before, life is full of inside experiences, except most of the times we don't quite recognize them or know what to do with them, or mm-hmm. you know, so they don't give rise to insight. But both of those were definitely experiences of those natures, of that nature. And you know, it's what that I believe Leonard Cohen was referring to in one of his songs, where he speaks of ring the bells that still can ring, there is a crack in everything, that's how the light gets through. These are the cracks when our mind-constructed view of reality, yes, little crack in the mind-constructed view of reality that shows
yeah,
us.
Yeah, it just stops for a second, like.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes. And these are good. And, you know, even if you don't have some profound insight as a result of it, it does show you something. It points you, not necessarily at a conscious level, but it mm-hmm. shows you more about the truth that you're pursuing.
Mm-hmm.
How does that happen in terms of the mind system model, that a crack appears? Is it a flaw in the programming? A virus? Bad coding?
Well, I think it's one of those things that inevitably happens. That in the mind system model, what we call the mind is actually made up of a number of other minds, and they exchange information through consciousness. Each one of those minds can project something into consciousness, and when they do, it becomes available to all the other minds. Then if we look at any one of those in any one of those minds that make up the mind system, we'll see it's made of many sub-minds. And likewise, those sub-minds communicate with each other through an information exchange locus, similar to what consciousness is in terms of the mind system as a whole. And then, if we were to look at one of those sub-minds, we'd find that it repeats the same structure. It consists of a whole collection of sub-sub-minds that communicate with each other through an information exchange locus. And so this goes down many, many levels. So what you see is that each mind is specialized in terms of particular functions, but they're all separate. The if you take the five sensory minds and the thinking emotional mind and the narrating mind, they can't really, they don't know what's going on with each other for the most part, except through what gets communicated in consciousness. So each one of those is functioning independently to create a view of reality that is specific to its own purpose, you know. So you don't have, your unconscious mind doesn't have a view of reality. It has many, many different worldviews at many different levels of complexity and differing from each other in terms of their function. So they contain different kinds of information and omit other kinds of information and relate that information in ways that are specific to their function. And they all develop, each sub-mind of the mind system develops its own worldview in independence of the others. So it's inevitable that sometimes, I suppose you could regard it as a flaw of the system, but I'd say it's just a characteristic of the system. That it's just, it's inevitable that in a system that's designed in that way, you know, that every now and then, the contents of consciousness don't fit the, you know, something arises that is outside of the realm of what for us is normal and usual. And what's interesting about that is, of course, whenever that happens, what makes something like that an insight experience is that all the different minds and sub-minds that observe this event, well, not all of them, but some of them will, it's like they're forced to rewrite their programming to incorporate. And unless you succeed in ignoring it, you can ignore this entirely. You can just say, oh, wow, that was interesting. Well, that was strange. And just brush it off. But if that doesn't happen, then every insight experience leads to some reprogramming of some of the sub-minds of the mind system. And our entire process, our life is a process of this. You know, from before birth. I mean, they're showing so much of how much mental development takes place before a child is born. The child hears the mother's speech, and the child actually experiences the chemicals and the substances in the blood that are absorbed from the digestive tract, and the hormones that are released in various emotional states and things like that. So the developing fetus, the mind of the developing fetus, is constructing reality even before birth. And then this continues. And it's a process of a constantly refining these models in all these different parts of the mind. And since you have so many different mental functions, each represented by a different part of your unconscious mind, you have as many different worldviews as you do components of the mind system. Remember, this is all just a model. I mean, you don't want to take this too literally. It is empty, after all. But you have as many different worldviews as you do minds and sub-minds and sub-sub-minds, and of as many different variety as there are mental functions to be formed, and as many different complexities as there are hierarchical levels in the, you know, progressively, you know, minds divided into sub-minds and sub-minds into sub-sub-minds, and each one is simpler than the last. The organization of information at each simpler level reflects that decrease in complexity. So no, it's not a defect or a flaw. As a matter of fact, it has the great benefit. I mean, depending on how you think of these things, it's a lucky accident that it is that way, because it's what allows us to continuously refine and eventually refine our worldview to the point of breaking through to the higher levels of the spiritual path. On the other hand, you could look at it not as a lucky accident as all, but in that the universe is evolving. And so it's there so it can evolve. The organization and behavior of the mind system is very comparable to what happens when a group of people are working together. And as a matter of fact, that is a group mind. It's a real mind. It doesn't have, it's not, at least at this stage and where we are now, a group of people working together. They do form a group mind, but it's not as cohesive a group mind as the mind of each individual's. But as we become more intricately interconnected and as the exchange of information becomes more and more refined, after all, the internet's like that. Anybody can project some information on the internet. And once they do, it's potentially available to everybody. Although, how many people will ever tune into it, you know. So that kind of is happening, and it does happen in a group. And groups work together. There are groups that work together well, and then there's the groups that work together in a way that give rise to the phrase designed by committee with all of its connotations. But really what the problems that happen that cause us to speak disparagingly of something that looks like it was designed by a committee is the lack of fluidity of communication. And more often than not, it's because all the members of the committee don't have equal input. But you can understand the nature of the mind system by looking at the nature of group minds that form. Yes.
So I found meditating this week to be exhausting. And is this something that's shared by early meditators? Is it a affliction of attitude? Is it a combination of nutrition and choline and things like that? Can you shed some light on that?
Okay, it is something that it is most common amongst fairly new meditators. The longer you meditate, it begins to have just the opposite effect. And, you know, you might experience a certain degree of fatigue or agitation in the first couple of days of a retreat. But then as you get deeper into it, it's just the opposite. You have much more energy. There's a lot of reasons for this. One of them is that you keep trying to do things, you know, and even though you know and are trying not to and are intending not to do things, you can't help yourself because you spent a whole lifetime trying to be someone who does things. Yeah. That's one of the more tiring things. The other thing that's tiring is expectations. It's very, very difficult not to develop expectations. And when you experience, when your expectations are disappointing, they're also energy draining. They sap your enthusiasm and so forth. And I could go on and on. There are a lot of things that tend to make retreats tiring. But even for somebody who hasn't meditated very much, if they stay in retreat for very long, it starts going the other way. And it starts being more energizing rather than more tiring. And these, you know, it's unfortunate that because of most people's circumstances, we have to do retreats that are, you know, a week or 10 days or 2 weeks or things like that. You know, I ideally every retreat would be at least a month, and some would be a bit longer. But it's not realistic. So, but on the other hand, it's not realistic for a group retreat to be like that. On the other hand, individual retreats, and there are people in this room who are staying on for quite extended solo retreats. We've had people do 8 months of retreat here. We've had Jeremy's done cumulative about 2.5 years of retreat.
Yeah. One follow-on question to that is, at what point is in somebody's practice do longer retreats, such as a month or longer, start making sense for somebody? I think if I were to start a 3-month retreat now, I wonder if it would do me any good.
It would do you tremendous good, actually. Yeah. You'd reach a point probably about 2 weeks into it where you think this is the biggest mistake you ever made in your life. And then a few days later, you totally change your mind. Yeah. Yeah. And I encourage people often say, well, I've only been meditating for a couple of months. I probably shouldn't do a retreat, should I? Or even beyond that, I've had people say, I really have never meditated before. Do you think I should do a retreat? And I say, yes, for sure. Best way to learn to meditate is do a retreat.
So I have a right now question and then a follow-up from yesterday, something that came up during the talk. So I've been increasing my sit time because that works better for me, but I've noticed that I'm getting some circulatory issues, some edema, and I didn't know if that's something to worry about. Not really major, but noticeable, and so I'm just wondering if I should be concerned about that.
So like
it's
your
not painful,
ankles
like my feet and feet. Legs, mm-hmm. and then my hands a little bit, but not as much as my feet.
I certainly make sure that there's nothing constricting your circulation. That's the first obvious thing, is to make sure that you're not. What it is, it's the flow of blood returning, and normally the blood in the legs moves into the upper body as a result of the muscular pumping action of the when you walk. Moving around, and so too much sitting can. If it's not a problem, I don't think it's. In most cases, people don't even notice it, except that maybe they see marks when they take their socks off, right? Yeah, and it's nothing to worry about. But if your feet started ballooning up, then we ought to have a closer look at it. That's not normal. But to be relatively inactive. And of course, if you're doing very slow walking meditation, then that's not that much different than sitting in terms of the vascular. But I believe you're doing some fairly vigorous exercise for part of the day, so. Well, unless it gets noticeable, don't worry about it. So the other question.
The other question was, I had an experience similar to what Chloe mentioned about when I had experiences of no self previously, then the loving kindness and compassion came up spontaneously at that time. So my question is, as I continue to sit after the retreat, if it comes up in that way again, is that when you would do, any of like the charnel kind of practices or any of that sort of thing, the death practices or?
I wouldn't unless I had some good reason for it.
Okay. Well, because it's in the Satipatthana, you've got to have a reason.
So is casino meditation. Almost nobody ever does that anymore except Pahal. So, if those experiences arise, I would try to penetrate them and absorb them as fully as possible. And it's very important when you have an experience like that in meditation, that when you get up and when you go about your other business, that you do your best to continue to hold that understanding, to hold that particular vision, reinforce it. Yeah. good.
Something occurs to me pretty regularly, and best way I can explain it is it's like I'm talking to myself, telling myself what to do, and I'm just curious if that's an experience that other people have, or if you could speak to what's actually happening there. Is that something I should ignore?
Yeah, it's something you should just ignore, let it happen. The thing is, don't get caught up in it and start, you know, let it capture your attention. But it's completely normal to have some part of your mind, you know, acting like a narrator or a coach, or, you know, everybody experiences that. And it does go away. Your mind gets calmer and there's much less of that. But even then, every now and then, you know, the inner coach will start telling you what you ought to be doing, or more likely asking, you know, thoughts start emerging in the form of questions, asking yourself about, well, what should I do next, or should I do this or that, things like that. So it's normal.
Yeah. Somebody give good advice?
Sure.
Yeah, it is. You know, it tells me, okay, now do this. It's not like a.
Yeah.
It's well, it goes on in my life.
Mm-hmm.
You know, not just when I'm at a retreat.
Yes,
so it's just
right.
Part of.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's a little hard to distinguish when it's reasonable and when it's mm-hmm. unreasonable.
Well,
when it's going to get me into some deep doo-doo.
Well, yeah, you know, there are some psychiatric disorders where that tendency does do that. That gets you in deep doo-doo. A certain amount of inner self-talk is normal and natural and tends to take care of itself. And it's certainly in meditation, you don't need to pay any attention to it at all. Some people are more verbal than others. And if you're a highly verbal person, then you'll probably have more of it. Some people are more visual and less verbal, and so, you know, they're more likely to have various kinds of imagery come up. But it's all just, you know, different parts of your mind trying to get involved in their own way. But for the most part, in meditation, it's best to just let them be. Let them come, let them be, let them go. Don't pay too much attention to them, unless the inner voice happens to say something that strikes you as particularly valuable and useful, you know. But for the most part, it's just mental chatter.
Thanks.
I'm curious where the experience of ourselves as a field of vibration and this sense of being process, where you would relate that in terms of the gateways to insight that you shared yesterday. And then I'd also be curious to hear what contemporary science says in terms of representing that experience of ourselves as process, as vibration.
Mm. Well, if contemporary science agrees totally with that, you see, in physics, you know, what everybody learned in school is that all material objects are made of molecules, and the molecules are made up of atoms, and the atoms are made up of electrons and protons and neutrons. And then they found quarks and gluons, and then they found finer particles and so on and so forth. And it's reached the point where it's apparent that that if you look for particles, you're going to find particles. But if you look for something else, and in physics, it's been realized that particles are interpretations of to account for forces and fields, and that really, you know, the image that we learned in school of the components of an atom as being these little marbly type things is, you know, there's a force. There's forces that are certain kinds of forces that are, you know, there were four, and then they combined the electrical and the weak force, so now there's three, and they're working towards, you know, ever since Einstein, hoping to find the one grand unified theory that reduces everything to a single force. But all of the particles that physics talks about are things that we make up to explain forces and fields. All we're measuring is the effects of the forces and the fields of them. You know, like if a particle has mass, it exerts a gravitational force, and that force has a field that's described by, you know, that reduced in strength with the square of the distance. And all of the different forces are like that. Every force has a particular strength and it has a particular field. And so really there's nothing but forces and fields. And you take it one step further and you realize that nobody's ever seen a force or a field. We only see the effects of forces and fields. So some people say that, and I agree with this, that it makes most sense to talk about the universe simply as information, because everything ultimately is just reduced to information. And then you have quantum physics, which says that even the behavior of whatever the stuff is that physicists play with, if we would, you know, if we would imagine that these forces and fields had some very, very high level of predictability, we find out that they don't. But really, all there are is probabilities. It's just pure probability. That the best way to describe everything in the world is in wave equations, that and the wave is really an expression of probability. What that means is that and you find this at a certain very small level. Now, with probabilities, for example, you flip a coin, you take a nickel and flip it. The probability is going to come up heads or tails. It's 50-50. Right? But it's quite possible to flip it 10 times in a row and have it come up heads. But the more times you flip it, the more it's going to turn out, closer it's going to be to exactly 50-50. So if you flip a coin 10 times, you might get a really skewed probabilistic, you know, you're in one tail or the other of the probability curve. But the more times you flip it, the more you'll be exactly in the middle. And that's the way the universe is. That these things that we think of as particles or as forces or forces and fields and so forth, at a very small level, they only behave as probabilities. There exists a probability. It's an extremely small probability. But the location of every single electron and proton and neutron in your head, for example, where it's going to be in the next blank instant is determined by probability. And there's a very, very small probability that every single one of those in the same relationship to each other, so it still looks like your head, might in the next moment show up on the other side of the room. But the probabilities are way against that. But it's completely possible. So, you know, definitely science is totally on with everything is process. And not only is everything processed, but everything is information.
And I'm curious how you would relate that, our experience of that, in terms of the doorway to insight.
Well, that. I tried that. I'm just going to hold it. Okay, where were we? That everything, and this is just a way of understanding it. Okay, let's be clear. To say that there are no things and there is only process is a superior way of conceptualizing reality. It's not the way things are. It's just a better way of conceptualizing reality than to conceptualize it as consisting of things. Okay? And to have insight into anicca, the impermanence, the radical impermanence that everything is process and there are no things, that's just one insight. And so you're having, it serves as a gateway, of the major insights. When I went through them over the last 2 days, or the last 2 days that I was talking to you, there wasn't the last two calendar days, but when I went over, I kept pointing out to you the ways that they overlap, that each one points to the other, and that they're connected. So the reason that having a very profound realization of one insight acts as a gateway is that all of the other insights, they're not really separate from it. They're inherently interconnected with it. And so it's like when you have that realization of anicca, then it allows those less well-developed insights to reach a higher level of maturity. So that's how it acts as a gateway. One of the things that you'll sometimes find in the literature that I have not found to be true is that as soon as you've realized one insight, it's just automatically you'll realize all of the others. So you have the gateway insight, and I found it doesn't actually happen that way. A lot of people will have profound insight into impermanence, and it'll take a long time after that for the other insights to mature. And actually people have had insight into impermanence without all these other insights, you know, they kind of think it's really fun and like it, right? it's when you have all the insights except no self that and they all begin to mature and become very strong, that you find yourself experiencing a lot of unpleasantness, because that everything is process and there are no things, by itself you can assimilate, you know. It can be a little bit disturbing, but you can get used to it, that there's nothing that you can grasp to. But when you combine that with the interconnectedness of everything, the causal interconnectedness of everything, you begin to realize your total powerlessness too. And that gets to be scary, you know, that you have no control over anything. And then when the insight into emptiness begins to mature, you've gone through your life thinking that you more or less had things figured out, and you could manage things. Now you're not only powerless, you realize you don't have a clue about the way things really are. Now it starts to get really disturbing, and you feel like, you know, your whole world is starting to crumble beneath your feet, and things have no meaning. And then you start to experience insight into suffering. And that's the direct experiential insight into suffering, when you start having all of these realizations grounded. So that what happens is you have this the unconscious worldview that can make you so uncomfortable is one in which you are still a separate self, but in a world that where there's nothing at all that you can grasp onto, in a world that you are really, relatively speaking, powerless to influence the course that drive your life, and that your knowledge and understanding is, you know, that's a really scary place to be. So often,
yeah, that was all problems. All problems.
While John is changing the battery, I would just like to say, practicing virtue, especially if these things begin to happen, and not stopping the practice, is definitely something. Don't stop practicing. Just definitely keep practicing if you begin to have those experiences.
Thank you. That is absolutely the best advice in the world. The one thing you don't want to do when you start to have these kinds of insights is to stop practicing. If you haven't already been practicing virtue, you better start real quick. But it would have been most beneficial had you already been doing it for months and years prior to that. The other thing is that we've talked a lot in the course of developing samatha, a lot of purification takes place, and when you start having insight, if you haven't done those purifications, you're going to have to do them then, and they're going to come up really strongly. And if you think some of the purifications that you've gone through, a few at a time in your meditation has been rough, just picture having all of the purifications come up all at once at the same time that these insights are maturing. So the most important things that you can do are to definitely practice the whole path, to have right understanding, because that will give your mind, even though perfect intellectual understanding of the Dharma won't do anything by itself, if you have that understanding as insight begins to mature, it gives your mind direction. Your mind knows, you know, as one way of seeing things becomes untenable, it has an alternative way or alternative ways of understanding things to work with. So right understanding is extremely important. The practice of virtue is extremely important. You know, so the more you do that, the better. Practice the whole path. Practice the whole path, and don't quit when it gets rough, because that's one thing about it. Once you've started to have these insights, you can't really hide from them for very long, no matter how hard you try. There's only one way to go, and that's forward. It's, you know, and So, what is this? Is better not to have begun at all, but once begun, better not to stop? I don't know. Somebody will remember that quote better than me. Don't stop. Absolutely don't stop. Better never to have started than to try to stop. Okay, Josh?
Yeah, my question was similar to the one you answered previously in terms of physical theories and fields. And it's, if you move a conductor through a magnetic field, it causes an electric current to flow. And so you've said that sense object, mental object, and consciousness arise simultaneously, but it's possible that the mental objects, sense objects, arise first, and then consciousness comes afterwards to recognize them. And I wondered if there was an analogy between the electromagnetic fields and the mental objects and consciousness.
I'm not really clear about the part you said, mental and physical objects arise first and then consciousness.
When you move the wire through a field, or you send a current through the wire and creates the field, one precedes the other.
Does one precede the other?
Yeah. When you send an electric current through the wire, there's no field until the wire has the electric field going through it. There's no magnetic field around the wire until the electric current goes through it. And I just wondered in the same way if somehow mental objects and sensory objects were inducing consciousness through a different field that we don't know about. Have you thought or have you seen that kind of analogy before?
No. And actually, I kind of have trouble getting past the idea that in what you describe, to me, the magnetic field arises at the same time that the electrical current moves, as the electrons begin to move. I can't conceive of one preceding the other, because it's actually an electromagnetic force it's an electromagnetic force in a state of relative, not pure, but relative stasis, and then it switches from relative stasis to relative movement. But the electromagnetic field has been constant throughout.
No, it's just if you move a conductor through the electromagnetic field, you create an electric current.
Right.
And that's what I'm...
Yeah.
The electric current wasn't in the conductor until you moved it in.
Except that's not really true. Even when the core didn't move through the coil, or even when the current didn't move through the coil, the electromagnetic fields and forces were already there, and they were actually already in a state of flux, even though they were relatively static. So. Anyway, to go, I think you're. I'm getting hung up on your metaphor, and it's better to go to your question. I understand and explain and view consciousness as a property of information exchange. Anytime information is exchanged, which requires that there be some kind of shared receptivity between the two or more entities that information is being exchanged, and the information exchange is itself the consciousness. So that that's why the Buddha said, and I agree completely, you cannot have consciousness without an object, because unless there is information in process of exchange, there is no consciousness, because consciousness is information exchange. So But that's something we could think and talk more about. Chloe's been waiting to say something. Oh. Okay. All right.
I just had a question, and I'm not quite sure how it relates to your system, but I'm thinking of times when there is that feeling like, oh my God, I'm a clueless dust mote. You know, we were just talking about the previous question, like, ah! Yeah. It seems sometimes helpful, at least in my experience, to come back to the body then and just be like, okay, breath. You know, that even though gravity is just an idea, I don't fly up in the air, you know, or I don't know. I'm not sure what you think about that.
Yeah, well, I don't think gravity is just an idea. But the theory of gravity is just an idea. That's right. Yeah. So, yeah.
But even if I think, oh my God, I'm just in dust mode, I can still function. Right?
Well, the thing is,
keep that in mind, you know?
Yeah, the distinction to make is about these things is you can consciously have that experience of feeling like I haven't got a clue, and it might trigger certain emotions, but it's not terribly disturbing and it usually goes away. But when it happens the other way around, when the unconscious parts of your mind are many of them simultaneously saying, wow, none of us have a clue, and you don't even consciously experience that as the thought, I don't have a clue. You just experience the emotion that's generated. And what makes it even worse is you don't even know why you're having that emotion. You just have this sense of anxiety and disturbedness, and it seems to have no apparent cause. You look all around you and you think about what's happening. There's no reason why I should feel like this. I must be losing my mind.
I just actually had a quick observation, and then I was wondering if you could go back to what you were speaking about yesterday. I do remember you talking about the three gateways, right? The voidness, impermanence, and suffering. And then you were going down the list of insights, and perhaps I wasn't paying complete attention, but I don't think that we actually made it through all of the insights.
Okay. Well,
and so I guess I'm asking if we can return to the teaching on the insights.
Yeah. Well, I'm trying to say. I think I talked about dependent arising or interconnectedness. I talked about impermanence. I talked about emptiness. I talked about suffering, and maybe I didn't talk enough about no self. Maybe that's the one that's... Well, that's the most important one, and that's the hardest one for most people. I mean, every now and then there's somebody that, you know, they realize that they're not a separate self, and it spares them. It spares them a lot. But are you saying you'd like me to talk more about no self?
I don't know, a quick review, perhaps no self. I was just noticing then also maybe the way that you were saying Tantra might not be as easy understood in the West. I think in the West, maybe our mindset so attached to science that scientific explanations are easier. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about the self. And the self is an idea. And there's two aspects to this idea. One is derived from a feeling we have. And it's the feeling that we're a separate self, a sense of being a separate self that's quite independent of any kind of intellection or analysis, and that, you know, a mouse has it and a bird has it, and, you know, it doesn't require any sort of sophisticated mental construct. to experience that feeling of self. And that feeling of self is the very last thing to go. When the feeling the feeling of being a separate self goes, then you're a Buddha. You know, then you're an Arhat. You know, you've at least in terms of the part of the path that's discussed, you know, here, you've made it. The other aspect of self is the mental construct that we create of who we are. And that's just purely a mental construct. It's not a feeling. But the two joined together, I mean, are really powerful and solid thing. I feel like I'm a separate self, and I know who I am. Now, the idea of self has no meaning without its opposite, which is other, you know, not self. Although you can, and in some traditions like the Advaita Vedanta, I mean, what they do is say, well, your real self, you know, is everything. there are no separate selves. But you can do that with it. But at that point, you've gone beyond the semantic meaning of the word self. Because otherwise, there can't be a self unless there's at least one thing that's not self. Right? Where does this come from? Well, if we look at what's happening in your mind, moment by moment, you have thoughts and sensations, all kinds of different thoughts, all kinds of different emotions, all kinds of different sensations arising and passing away in consciousness. And you have a part of your mind that it's in the Yogacharans called it the I consciousness, but I call it the narrating mind. And what it does, its job, it has a very important job. It takes this, all of these, you know, this sequence of all these different sensations mixed with all of these different thoughts and ideas and feelings that are arising, and it organizes them in a meaningful way. And it groups together certain sensations and identifies them as an object that you are sensorially aware of, that you might be seeing and hearing at the same time, for example. And so it creates a story. Call it the narrating mind. It's a storyteller. It sorts through all of this data that's coming flowing through, and it makes up a series of stories. And all in each episode, it is made up of a series of statements, like, I saw this, and I felt this way about it, and I acted this way because of it. And okay, so the narrating mind creates stories, and the narrative center of gravity is the I. So then the rest of them, this gets projected into consciousness. And the rest of the mind system sees this story of the story of I and believes the story of I. It believes there must be somebody named I, because after all, they've been following this story of I for a long time. And you can't blame the narrating mind, because it can't create a story, you know, without some narrative center of gravity to hang the different events and changes and experiences on. So it creates that. And it's not the fault of the I consciousness. It's actually the fault of the rest of the Alaya consciousness, right? Because the rest of the Alaya consciousness just gets in the habit of believing that it is an I or that there is, and I shouldn't say that it is, it gets in the habit of believing that there is an I. Okay? All these different sub-minds. Yep, there's an I. I've heard about, been hearing this about this I all my life. It's very real, right? And this I exists in a world of its, right? There's all its all over the place, and I and it are always interacting with each other, and it does things to me, and I do things to it, and, you know. And in the Yogacara description of what happens when you realize no self, the change takes place not in the narrating mind, because the narrating mind is going to keep doing its job for the rest of your life, because otherwise it would be very awkward and you couldn't survive. But the description they say is there is a rotation within the alaya, which is the rest of, that's really in all of the other sub-minds that make up the unconscious. There's this rotation, and the rotation is to away from there is an I to everything is interconnected. That's what has to happen. And the problem is, what makes it so difficult to realize no self is that you have to have an alternative explanation. Something has to take its place. You know, in a very complex piece of logical machinery, which your mind is, you can't just rip out something as central as the concept of I without something to replace it. And what replaces it, and this is why this is what makes dependent arising so incredibly important. It's such a key thing. There are some teachers, and I agree with them, I don't quite take the same approach to presenting the Dharma, but there's some teachers who present the Dharma as being about nothing but dependent arising. Everything else flows from dependent arising. And I agree with them totally. I just take a different approach to teaching the Dharma. But it's really true. If you don't have a deep understanding of not just the causal interconnectedness, I mean, that's if there's two parts to dependent arising, the easy part is the causal interconnectedness, the easier part. Although even there, you know, it's got to do a little bit of work. The hard part is what I referred to as a holographic nature, the interpenetrating nature, which, by the way, physics finds as well. You know, I mean, physicists have been running around in circles ever since they did experiments that demonstrated non-locality, that particles separated by the width of the entire universe, something happens to one of them and it changes the other one, you know. So physics says the same thing that that deep meditators say, that there is this aspect of dependent arising that's not just causal interconnectedness, but it is the interpenetration of everything that is. Of course, everything that is are just the constructs of our mind to try to explain something that is beyond our capacity to explain. So no matter what view you hold, no matter what model you create, no matter what description you provide, it's going to be wrong, because only the mind of God can grasp the mind of God. You know, only emptiness knows emptiness. You know, only ultimate reality knows the nature of ultimate reality. But we're all participants in that. And when we realize, that's really what we're after, is to have the complete and total realization that we are part of that we are a manifestation of that. That's where we're trying to go with. And that's what replaces the notion of I. And that's what allows the mind to now hear the story of I and it, while knowing that there is no I and it, but that our minds require an I and it in order to make sense of things. And that's just a limitation of ours. And I'm not going to go over time as much as usual, but I want to just, there's something that I think demonstrates very clearly. A lot of people are attached to the idea that somehow, as a process of their awakening, that they're going to achieve a kind of omniscience that allows them to fully grasp the true nature of reality, for a Shentong who believes that there is such a thing, or who believes that they can fully grasp ultimate truth. And for those, I would point out that, you know, compare the mind of the first amphibian, some how many hundreds of millions or whatever years ago, and it had a worldview. It had a view of reality. It had the best view of reality it could construct with the equipment it had available to construct it. We have lots better equipment, and so we create a much better construct to describe reality. And I think we can safely assume that it's much closer to being an accurate description of ultimate reality. But how close? How close? Well, let's assume that intelligence continues to evolve in the same way that it has since that first amphibian up to ourselves, and that's on a curve like this. It's not a linear process, it's an accelerating curve. So now let's go 100 million years in the future and see what kind of minds have evolved, and their perception of the ultimate nature of reality is going to bear the same relationship that ours does to that primordial amphibian. But in a way, and once again, this is just a model, this is just a way of thinking of it, but the way I like to think of it, well, I have to throw something else in here, and that is, just as, okay, non-duality, matter and mind as being two distinct things is an illusion. There's only one stuff. And it looks like matter when you look at it one way, and it looks like mind when you look at it the other way. But all the things that you discover when you look at it as matter also apply when you look at it as mind, and vice versa. Okay? And we've already talked about how everything in the material universe is interconnected and interpenetrating. So we don't have individual minds. What we have is an individual mind is a filter that filters out all the information that's not directly relevant to making one particular kind of event happen for a little while. I mean, get that? You're just a particular kind of event that's happening for a little while. Right? And we're all interconnected. And so a model that I have is that the universe as a whole is evolving towards a state of all-encompassing consciousness. And yeah, that's why everybody is a bodhisattva, because nobody can achieve complete and total awakening until everybody has achieved complete and total awakening. And a ramification of the theory of consciousness as information exchange is that consciousness pervades the universe. No, let's put it this way. The stuff, the the phenomenon that we call consciousness, when we see it happening at a particular level of organization corresponding to people and certain kind of animals, that same process, that identical process, happens at every level throughout the entire universe. Everything is conscious, although not in the subjective experiencing kind of way that we are, but every atom and molecule, every rock, every mountain, every sun, every planet is it partakes of that same process that we call consciousness. So I'm a little tired and losing track of where I was going with this. Yes.
So how does the subjective experience go about replacing the story of I am and it with the story of interpenetrating and interconnectedness?
Well, it doesn't replace it so much as it sees through it. The Buddha, in order to eat and teach and take care of himself, his mind still still had the eye consciousness that told the story that was necessary to allow this. But the thing is that he didn't believe a bit of it. He didn't need to believe a bit of it. And the same thing happens essentially when you achieve stream entry, is you realize that you aren't a separate self. You still feel like a separate self, but you realize that you're not. And so that has an effect on the ego self, that other, the mental construct, so that now it becomes transparent. You kind of see through it. And that's what makes you a stream enterer, is that the ego self has, you've achieved a certain transparency. Yes, go ahead.
So to talk about the no self, the time I have sort of a struggle with that my mind is trying to grasp at creating a story it can't create. Mm-hmm. It's hardest with the bodhisattva vows, because in that moment there's this realization that as none of this is separate from me, when this achieves full enlightenment, everything should achieve, be fully enlightened.
Yeah. Yes, and that's what I'm saying.
It's like a mental bouncing back before trying to read the word I and then trying to like not relate to this.
Yeah, right. And that's the thing is, as long as you have this sense and which you will have for a while yet to come, what is an I? What are the character of it, the characteristics of it? Well, for one thing, it's singular. You know, we don't think of ourselves as made up of a collection of I's, and an I is singular. And it's enduring. It's been the same I as long as we can remember, and we totally expect it to continue to be the same I. And when we have the thought that it might at some point cease to be the same I, it makes us feel real scared, right? Yeah. And the other thing, of course, is that it's separate. And we have to overcome all three of these things. So we have to overcome the separateness. And we do this by stages. In terms of the ego self, it's not that hard to realize that I actually have many egos. And I put on different ones. It's like a closet full of costumes that I put on. And I see myself, you know, there's costumes that I never wear anymore that I once did, and there's costumes that I haven't even dreamed of that someday I'll have occasions to wear. So the I loses its singleness. There is this quality of causally determined persistence that's there, but we're constantly changing, right? It is not, you know, not only is it not a singular I, it's not the same I. You are absolutely not, you're not the person that you were when you were 10 years old. I mean, you're probably much more that person over there than you were the person when you were 10 years old. You know, I mean, it's at least it's about as likely that you are, you know. And we're constantly changing. The I is composite. It's constantly changing. The I is a process. The hard part is the separateness. And so we continue to struggle with that. So we can understand our ego self as being multiple and constantly changing. And that's a much more enormously comfortable place to be. Then the ego becomes transparent. That's very liberating. And every time you start suffering because of what I want or I don't want or things like that, you just see through the illusion that there is no I. As you go along and that understanding deepens, the I becomes more and more illusory, then you stop worrying about the end of the I, because you know that there's nothing there to have an end. You know, it's like when people would ask the Buddha, and so like when you die, are you annihilated? Is that it? Or do you keep on going? And the Buddha just shook his head and walked away, you know, and Ananda said, well, you know, now he thinks you don't know. He said, there's no point. If I, anybody who thinks that the I exists at all is going to conclude that it either has to continue to exist, whether it's for a little while or forever, or that it's going to be destroyed. And that's what you're working towards, is the understanding, the really deep understanding, the insight that there never was an I, never could be an I, never will be an I, and all these things that you might worry about if you believe in the I just go away, and you stop worrying about it anymore. They don't matter. You still have the feeling of separateness to deal with, though, and you still have to work on that. And the way, yeah, and there's a systematic way of working your way through that.
Through the feeling of separateness, it's the thing that keeps it clinging.
Yes, that attachment. You get to the stage where, you know, that's really the only thing that you still are attached to. You know, you're truly in the formless realm there, where you're still attached to the continuation of this separateness. But that goes too eventually. And so now, well, I think I really should wrap this up. Okay? I'm not going to go over time to the degree that I have in the past. So, thank you. A good discussion.